baby elephants saved my life. I never realized animal videos were my greatest form of self-care, partially because I didn't know what the hell self-care meant, despite seeing meme after meme on Instagram referring to it. The day after the election in 2016, I could barely drag myself to work, but drag I did. When I arrived, I sat at my desk, incapable of doing any actual work, so I went online to find something that wouldn't be triggering, which wasn't easy. That was when I started to watch animal videos. That day I watched them for 8 hours straight. A couple weeks ago, I found myself feeling similarly distraught, so I went to Netflix to find an animal documentary. I watched an hour-long piece narrated by David Attenborough about a family of elephants. It followed one herd from the birth of a baby through a long journey they take across the countryside. All along, the baby is doing everything for the first time, walking, eating, rolling in mud. And the adult elephants work together, protecting the young one and helping them along the way. It would be like if your neighbors or coworkers cared for your child as much as you do. It was beautiful and hilarious, and that sort of reminder I needed that there is goodness in the world. It saved me in that moment. Now I know where to go when I need to recharge. The animals are only a few clicks away. Self-care, my friends. Go find whatever it might be for you. I recommend starting with the baby elephants. Welcome to The Subtext from American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group. I am Brian James Polak. On this episode, I speak with Mike Liu, author of Teenage Dick, presented by Mai Theater Company at the Public Theater in New York City. I was actually in New York to record this conversation with Mike in the offices of American Theater and TCG. It was cool to be in the epicenter of the American theater world. Mike Liu's plays include Teenage Dick, Tiger Style, Bike America, Microcrisis, and Mustache Guys, among others. He is a Tony voter, Dramatists Guild Council member, and resident of New Dramatists. He's also the co-director of Mai Writers Lab, the largest collective of Asian American playwrights in the country.
I haven't spent that much time in Chicago. There was a the first annual Ignition Festival at Victory Gardens, and I was in that, and I haven't been back since.
Yeah, Victory Gardens is incredible. Yeah, they do awesome work there. That was basically the first thing I did when I came to town was go to the Ignition Festival because it's in August.
Oh, right. So last year's.
Yeah. So I arrived in Chicago on Monday, and the festival was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I was like, oh, this is kind of dope.
Did you drive?
From LA to Chicago? Yeah.
You drove cross country?
Yeah.
So you stowed all your stuff in your new place or whatever, and you just hit the town?
Oh, yeah. Actually, my furniture and stuff hadn't even arrived yet. So I had two beach chairs in the living room, packed in the car, and then an air mattress I had just bought at Target. Yeah.
And my girl... You went out,
Yeah. And my girlfriend and I were just living in this, sparse place, and I'm already okay, I'm in town now, let's start getting to know people. And what was kind of cool was I'm in town for 3 days, go to this awesome festival, and people I knew from LA were there.
Oh, we're out there?
At the festival.
Oh, really cool.
Yeah, so it was kind of I'm away, but I'm not away,
I was just thinking about the first time that I moved to New York yesterday because it's been so hot. Has it been hot like this in Chicago at all? Or
it's been brutally hot.
Worse,
yeah.
So I moved the year of the blackout, and I like you had an apartment and a crash pad and nothing. I think I had a mattress, and my sister and my parents were crashing, but there was. Not only did I not own an AC, but one could not operate it because it was a blackout. And my sister was pretty young at the time and was convinced that if I opened the window that, because we were on the first floor, that marauding New Yorkers would jump in. And there were bars on the window, but and it was so hot. And so she, I got her to agree to letting me open the window for 10 seconds. and she counted down from 10, and then I wouldn't close it, and she was too small to close the window herself, and she's like, you asshole! Like, and anyway, but the point being that, like, it was so hot that I would flash back to during blackout times and not having any furniture, and but unlike you, well, no, that's not true. I was going to say, I didn't hit town, but I did, because I was directing a free show in Washington Square Park, so... Mm-hmm. I actually left my family in the dark to go skateboard to this to make sure that the show went okay, and there were no lights. And then I skateboarded back, and my my poor family was like, "We tried to cook some soup on the gas stove with a match."
Oh, that's brilliant! When was this?
I think it was. So it had to be the summer of 2003, which is when I moved.
That's when you moved here.
Yeah.
What prompted the move?
Just theater. Like, my parents were so wigged out about the idea of going into theater that they were like, you have to just move and do it. So I went directly from... They helped, but I went directly from college to here because they were just so scared about the uncertainty of being in theater that I think that they thought that if, like, we put you in this sort of, like, hardcore, like, move directly, like, kind of situation that you'll be scared and, like, I don't know, go to law school or whatever.
That seems so antithetical to what I imagine most parents saying. Like, are you crazy? Theater? Go to law school.
I think it was sort of like, we have taught you all we can, so fly, baby bird. And I think that their image of New York was not too far from my sister's, right? So they were just sort of like, you're gonna hit town, be scared, and then retreat to the safety of, you know, respectable grad school. But it never happened.
Yeah, I think they watched too many movies from the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Where New York is always wet.
Right.
It's always dark, and everyone's wearing leather.
Yeah.
Right.
It's dark and hot. Yeah. They're wearing leather and like all the reflections of neon lights and mm-hmm. And yeah, and everybody. It's like summer, and people are just kind of all robbing each other.
Yeah. Yeah. That was sort of my mother didn't visit Los Angeles. I lived in Los Angeles for about 10 years, and my mother didn't visit for a very long time, and I think there was this underlying fear that every neighborhood has drive-by shootings.
Right.
Like, it's just an inevitability, and she didn't want it to happen the time when she's visiting.
You were you grew up in New England?
I grew up in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And I grew up in San Diego, so I think it's the same kind of, like, stereotypes in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Because San Diego has this feeling of being like this safe, insular place.
Sure.
It's almost like idyllic.
Yeah.
Because the weather is the best of, it's probably like the best weather in the country. Right?
I like it. I like it quite a bit better than this, sweltering.
It's not as, it gets hot, but I you know, the heat in Los Angeles can be brutal, but it's not, it's dry. I mean, they say it's a dry heat. But the truth is, now that I moved to Chicago and I'm here in New York, I forgot humidity.
Yeah, that exists.
And humidity is second level heat. And I'm realizing, oh man, 90 degrees in LA is, like, it feels hot on your skin, but I can walk through the street and with sunglasses on and a hat and I'll be okay. But man, you add humidity to that.
Oh yeah, I'm like on a 2-3 shirt regimen. I'm like my child. Oh,
I've got to go to Target and buy some shirts while I'm on the East Coast because I did not pack for this. This is rough. Anyway, you grew up in, I want to go backwards in time a little bit.
Were we supposed to say our names or anything or what we're doing here? Do you all that front matter?
I do all of that. Yeah. Later.
I like that. We just like jumped in.
Yeah. We just roll in.
Yeah. I'm sorry, so you, okay, you wanted to go back.
Yeah, so go back in time. I want to learn about your sort of connection to, your original connection to theater, like what brought you to it in the first place.
I didn't have a ton of exposure to theater in my youth. I remember going to a couple of kids' shows, and my parents were subscribers to the Old Globe, but that was like kind of their date night that mm-hmm. they would leave the kids and sort of, you know, we're going to go see a play. And so I didn't know much about theater growing up. And I wrote two class plays in high school that were like, you had to incorporate 2 years worth of English students. Like, so they were big cast, like 30-something nonsense plays with my best friend who went on to Cambridge and law school. So he made better choices than I did. And then I in college, I really stumbled into it and just started directing like a play a semester, sometimes two plays a semester, and came into playwriting more towards the end of college and like upon moving here. And it was almost like it was a half artistic and half calculated decision, like the artistic side of things being that I wanted to tell my own stories more than wanting to interpret other people's stories as a director, and the calculated side being that it just felt as though for freelance directors in New York that you really couldn't make a mark until you were quite established, because it's like there's so many directors here, and so you could maybe direct a reading or a 10-minute play, like, but you wouldn't really be actually premiering work and doing what you had trained to do for several decades, whereas it was possible to write a really sparkling play and get going.
When I was in high school, theater was so far off of my radar that I didn't, I may have said this in a previous podcast, but I didn't realize plays were still being written.
You thought it was like a dead form?
I thought all the plays that existed had already been written, and that when you go to see a play, you're going to see one that was from 100 years ago. And that at some point, 100 years ago or more, that's when the plays were written. Like, the concept of even being a dead form didn't even... like,
it was just sort
register.
Of. It was like.
It was a period of time in history when plays were written.
And then it stopped.
Right.
Right. That totally
makes
sense.
Kind of like sculptures. Marble sculptures were made in a certain period of time, and then nobody's making marble sculptures.
Or like
anymore.
Like Renaissance paintings or something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's like a yeah. That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
You're making me remember that my senior year of high school, there was this. This thing called the American Academy of Achievement, and they had these high school students that I don't know how like they got patched into this thing, but like there were adult honorees, and then there were a bunch of high school kids that descended on them, and they were allowed to ask questions. And so, but it was like a wide range of people because it was cultural figures like Coretta Scott King, or like I remember there was a panel with her and with Babyface at the same time, and then there. Like, what do you think about civil rights, Babyface? And then there were Nobel scientists, but this is the first time that I'd ever met living writers. So like you, I was there was a biographer there, Edmund Morris, and there was like George Lucas and James Cameron, but I'd never met living writers before, and my family was so sciencey that like I just didn't even know that there were people out there who made their living writing.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we probably both grew up in pretty provincial circumstances, and so there's, without modeling, it's hard to even kind of imagine yourself in a space other than sort of...
Yeah, but what I found interesting is that you said in high school you wrote these plays, so what made that connection for you? Was it a specific assignment to tell you, were you told to write a play, or did you have to create something and then you decided for it to be a play?
I was in this like nerd program called IS or Independent Studies. And it's like 2 years of high school. It's like a English and history, humanities program for like in your sophomore and junior year. And, it was a bunch of really smart, eclectic nerds, and one of the things that they would do every year is this class play. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like assigned to me or anything. It was just sort of like, who would like to write a class play? And my friend and I did so both years, but we were just goofing around. And actually, I mean, in a way, like that aesthetic stayed with me until 25 or so, because I was sort of like, why can't I just write a 2-hour thing where it's like all jokes? And then at a certain point, because of my wife, really, like who's also a playwright, like like it sort of dawned on me that audiences would sit through your romp for 2 hours and be really, in a way, mad that like how dare you make me laugh for 2 hours, but like not have any point. And, so yeah, I mean, like it started out almost like these were 45-minute like cast of 40 structureless joke fests, and it's only been like in my current career that I was like, oh, you have to have characters that you give a shit about, and you have to have a plot, and otherwise people will get cranky about it. And so in a way, like, my writing style got established all the way back in high school, but was like beaten into like a sort of form that's acceptable now.
And was that out of did you make that switch out of, did you believe in the necessity of making that switch? Or were you doing it out of just sort of, I want to get by, I want to, you know, I want my plays to reach more people? Or did you believe that dramaturgically this was the right way to go?
I mean, I think that, yeah, so like, because Rahana and I read each other's work and have sort of been artistically engaged since like 2005, so like very soon after I moved to New York, that has been an ongoing sort of like locking horns of ours that like she usually writes these dramas that are pretty stark, and I had been writing these sort of bonkers comedies, and so that, like, part of it has been like a meeting in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then also I went to Juilliard and graduated in like 2013 or so, and Marsha and Chris, who ran the program, were very structuralist, and like not in like a dogmatic way, but almost just in sort of like a, I'm not going to engage with this play unless you come correct. And so it was like those sort of forces that were kind of cluing me in that was a necessity. But then it was also like, I was lucky enough to get my stuff in front of audiences a few times, like before I thought about any of these things. And it just like, you would end up having to rebuild the thing in previews or something, that like you would realize that like, I built a thing that, you know, like I built an airplane that can fly, but it was like, no, there was no aerodynamic consideration. And now I'm rebuilding this plane like in mid flight, and that doesn't feel very good. And so like, Right. So of late, like I started out by like making blueprints and doing mock-ups and thinking about things like that, so that like when I launch that plane, it flies instead of just like, oh, this is a rock that I have to like quickly Right. Put wings on.
And isn't there that famous metaphor that Marsha Norman likes to use about when you take off, when you're, it relates to a plane. I remember her saying this, if you're in a plane to fly to Buffalo, you better land in Buffalo.
Yes, there's that, and then there's like also like a ski lift one where she's like, you're on the ski lift and you want to make sure that you're going up the mountain that you think you're going up. I mean, there's all sorts of like, Right. There's all sorts of like of metaphors like this that are essentially come down to like, A, I need to know by page 20 like when I can get up and leave so that I'm tracking something, and B, like you should set up expectations for me that make me know that I'm in good hands, and that like if I'm on a roller coaster that takes twists and turns, that there's something sort of tethering me to the ground, to the earth, so that I feel at leisure to have fun on that ride and not fear for my life.
Do you feel like that's necessary? Do you feel like it's crucial to do that in plays, or can plays just be these freewheeling?
I mean, I think for me now, I haven't cracked a way to not do it. I feel like I've been burned on doing the opposite, like trying to kind of make up form or trying to make up my own structure. And now I just think that I have lots of flights of fancy within a play, but that I really think about the causality from scene to scene. Mm-hmm. But that said, it's like different stories or different sort of thematic meat that you're trying to pick through requires different modes of storytelling. So I don't try to make every play structured exactly the same. I think that I just put a lot more forethought into what is the thing that I want to be wrestling with, and then like what is the best vessel for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think about that? Do you just go like, do you outline, or do you?
What I've been thinking about a lot is, I think I started to write plays seriously, with any sort of seriousness, about 11 years ago, and my instincts were taking me in non-dramaturgically sound directions. Like, not all my scenes had conflict. It wasn't always clear what characters are going after, but I believed in the overall journey of the play. Like, there was something the plays were trying to say. I was surrounded with people who were very strict with their dramaturgy. It was very Aristotelian. And it felt hard for me because I didn't. That's not where my natural sort of creative instincts wanted to go. And I started to change over the first several years of writing into identifying these sort of expected forms in playwriting. Like you need, like you were just talking about, you need to set up the conflict and you need to let people know the journey that they are on, the expectation the audience has through the journey of the play. And lately I've been thinking about how I wonder how I would have evolved as a writer if I didn't start to morph into these traditions with my own writing. Now I'm kind of wired now, I think, the way I approach a play, without even really being conscious of it, the conflict is set up. Like all these basics are set up and naturally installed into the piece. I'm writing plays that are satisfying to me, but I'm just very curious if I was set free as a creative person, what direction would I have gone in?
That's really interesting that you say all of that. It makes me think of two things. The first is just that, like, in some ways, I wonder whether finding your voice at the top end of your career, like, it's too hard in a way to be placed with these structural burdens early on because you're still trying to figure out how you sound and it may feel sort of too limiting. Mm-hmm. So, I wonder whether in some ways we're kind of on a similar path in terms of not having as much structure and then thinking more about it, but then potentially chafing against it. But the other thing that it makes me think of is that I used to be an admin assistant at New Dramatists, mm-hmm. and so I was writing grants, but then there were all these like master playwrights that were kind of coming through and I was getting to pick their brains, and Anne Washburn was a member at the time, and she was like, "Oh, I really envy you that you can write about whatever you want." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" Like, and of course, for her to say that is crazy, right? Because she seems as though she writes about whatever she wants, and she's like, "But when you're at the beginning of your career, there's no real sort of limitations placed upon you." And she's like, "I feel," so she would have been the same age probably that we are now, mm-hmm. like when she was saying this to me, that she's like, "I feel as though, based on what I know how to do and like what people expect of me, that like in some ways, I can't write about whatever I want and that I'm like a little bit more bound." And I'm like, "But don't you feel like, doesn't that feel incredibly frustrating?" And she was like, "It's kind of like hiking. You can go down this path and it's the same path every time, but there's different seasons, so there's some comfort in that." And it was an incredibly bleak thing in a way, like for her to sort of lay that out, especially for somebody who is writing in such fantastical directions, like, but I guess she knows inside of her writing kind of what is sort of locked or bound or doesn't feel as though it's changing from play to play.
Yeah, in some conversations with people I've heard playwrights talk about commissions kind of painting them into corners sometimes, like feeling the need to deliver plays in a certain way. And how that can, I'm not sure if you've experienced this at all, that can limit your sort of like creative approach to a piece.
I don't have that many outstanding commissions at this time, but I've been cautious not to pick up too many because I've known a couple of writers who have kind of become better known from a breakout play and then they get almost saddled with like too many commissions and feel bogged down by it. And like, for me, it's less about a mode of writing that's expected and more that, like, if you are, I don't know, it's kind of like books that you are assigned to read in a class as opposed to ones that you pick up for pleasure. And mm-hmm. I feel as though you've just been assigned a play in a way and it becomes a little bit less fun, especially for commissions mm-hmm. where you have to, like, kind of put in a proposal for, like, here's what I want to do, because, like, the very act of writing the play is you wrestling with these big ideas and trying to sort of make a physical form for it and trying to attack that that question or that idea from a bunch of different angles and sort of exercise it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in a way, if you write out a proposal of like, here's what I want to explore, and here's what I think. Here's my thesis about this, that you've kind of inorganically jumped that exploration phase, and then it's not live for you anymore.
Yeah.
So it is kind of a, like, we need them to survive, right. But it's they are limiting in a way. It's weird.
Yeah, I think how my work is at its best when it's on its own schedule, when I am writing for myself and I'm able to live with it in my head.
Yeah.
For as long as it needs to be there, you know, and sometimes it's 3 months, sometimes it's 9 months or a year where I'm working on other things. But in those times where I'm driving the car, riding on the train, and I'm able to just sort of like let my brain play around with these characters and these ideas until they're all sort of like settled in some way. And I think commissioning or being on a very strict schedule for the writing itself, like if you're writing for a deadline, suddenly you're not setting yourself up to succeed as well.
Yeah, it's weird because it's like, I would have trouble coming up with a commissioning structure that works. Like, so it's, it, I mean, I just think that like, nobody's gonna like just sort of give us free money and be like, whenever you right. want, drop a thing.
But
like,
isn't that the one that would work?
Right.
Here's thousands of dollars, whenever.
Whenever, just when. Like,
yeah.
So it's like, it's reasonable that they expect deadlines. It's reasonable that,
oh, sure,
that they
yeah.
are
yeah.
like, what are you thinking about writing?
Right.
And yet there's something that's like very, I mean, it might kind of relate to why I love playwriting so much and why I've been a little bit more hesitant to jump into like TV film kind of stuff that's like so prescribed up front, you know? Mm-hmm. There's something rebellious about I'm thinking about this thing on my own time and at my own leisure, and when I'm damn well ready to drop this mm-hmm. knowledge on you, I'm going to drop it on you and like sort of see whether in the free marketplace anybody else like believes that my thing is horseshit or not. Like I just think that like the way that we tick and the way that structure is set up are like kind of adverse, but I'm not a theater and I don't know how to solve that.
Right. And you don't need to solve it.
Thanks.
I moderated a panel. Maybe it was about a year ago for SAG-AFTRA Foundation, and it was a panel of playwrights who were writing for television. So there was these four playwrights. They were all actively writing for TV at the moment. And I kind of went into that conversation expecting them to be lamenting the experience relative to theater, like yearning for the freedom of being a playwright. And I had this line of questioning that was really kind of expecting them to be like, yeah, I so much prefer writing plays over writing television. And all four of them were just like, no, this is a great, like, we love what we're doing. And maybe some of that was just due to the fact that they were all writing for shows that they would probably be watching if they weren't writing on them. But sometimes the writers will get trapped on shows that they don't really care for, you know? But I was, because I don't write for TV, that was the sort of, like, downfall I imagined, that you get into a TV writer's room and you're not on your own anymore. You're writing somebody else's vision and you're just carrying the ball forward as part of a team rather than it being an individual sport, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Because so many of our peers staff, and I have only ever done like sort of work for hire, quick, like, jump in and write a script, but never like done a full room.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really comment on it other than I just think that different writers, like what makes them tick or what makes them excited about the work, it's like so different, right? And so I just think that some playwrights are really cut out for staffing and others maybe not. I either haven't pursued it hard enough or don't quite have the disposition. But I also think that, like, we go through different phases. I don't know, like, whether, like, where your writing comes from in terms, but, like, a lot of mine comes from a place of like, exasperation or ire or, like, something that's, like, really burning for me that I want to, like, chip away at and that, like, because every play takes so long from its, like, first draft and, like, if you're lucky enough to get a production up through production, like, this last play that I have up now took like this whole sort of gestation time was like 6 years. Like, mm-hmm. so it's gotta be something that's like substantive enough that you want to be chipping away at this thing for 6 years. And I think that like you go through phases of like, I'm not always going to have something that's going to bother me for 6 years. Like,
right, yeah.
There's going to be other times in my life where I just want to put a, you know, put that writing skill to use, and there's not like this thing that's weighing on me. Maybe not currently with this political climate, but like that there's, you know, like phases where you just want to be put to work and use your skills, and then there's other times where you're like, this is something that's like really important to me that I have to like work through in a real multi-year way,
mm-hmm.
and in a way like I'm going to write it before I know where it's going to go, and I don't care that like I don't care that like it might not see the light of day, but like I to like purge this thing as a person have to work on this, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it's like too much to ask of all writers everywhere to like have that feeling all the time, you know?
Yeah. How did you lock into playwriting? So what did you go to study in the first place when you went to undergrad?
I didn't know for sure, but I'd done a lot of science-y stuff in high school. Like, so aside from this like weird humanities program, like I worked in a bio lab and like did Science Olympiad and science fairs and things, and my parents are doctors, and so like I really had like this path that was laid out for me that's like, you're gonna do science stuff, like not from a like, my parents insisted that I had to, but just more from like I knew no other thing.
And did you feel an aptitude for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I was good at it, even though I don't think that I loved it ultimately. Like I remember I wrote this this genetics paper that like, because I'd been interning at this lab for like 2.5 years and was doing all these like experiments, and like every word was founded in experiments, and mm-hmm. like that was, you know, I mean that was like, that was a weighty thing to know that like I'm writing this like whatever like 60 to 80 page thing, and it's like all backed in data, and that. you know, so I do feel like I had an aptitude for it, but at a certain point I was like, it was like on my birthday and I was alone in this lab at like 10 at night and while a high school student, and I was like, I don't want to have every word have this much backing. Like, what if I could write without having everything be so substantiated? And what if I just make things up and not make up like my data, but do you know what I'm saying? That there was a certain contrast to like, on one hand, like scientific writing having like all of this sort of substantiation and forethought, and on the other hand, like maybe it doesn't have to be that hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I went into undergrad thinking that I would do something more scientific, but like as of like first semester, like I started directing a play and like took theater classes and just like really fell for it. I mean, maybe it was like because my parents were pretty academically inclined and sort of, you know, meddlesome in terms of like you're not going to play video games all summer, you're going to do
right.
like substantial things, and so maybe it was a matter of like kind of getting out of their clutches and going across the country and sort of not having them looking over my shoulder to be able to sort of do my own thing, but I really trace like my interest, or at least like sort of my professional kind of curiosity, to college.
So when you came out of college, you moved to New York, were you in your head, I am a playwright now? Or were you like, because you mentioned about directing plays.
Yeah, so I wrote two plays in college. They were both pretty bad. But I was a lot more preoccupied with directing. And I think that I also wanted to convince myself that theater was like a serious discipline that had like, you know, because it's coming from science, so it was like,
right.
There have to be rules here, and it has to save lives or whatever. And more than anything, though, like because directing, you get to really see all aspects of production. Like I think that I was also learning on the fly because I had no formal training.
Mm-hmm.
So I was much more focused on directing than anything else, and like interned at Playwrights Horizons for their directing residency, which is how I met Moritz von Stolpnagel, who's like a longtime collaborator,
mm-hmm.
And he kept directing and I shifted over. But I was assisting a lot and directing short plays, and then just really fell hard for playwriting like a couple years out.
Was there a moment or a hook?
There was actually a hook. What happened was I was in Lincoln Center Director's Lab in the summer of 2005, and it's a 3-week long lab that's like based in Lincoln Center for, I want to say like say 60 directors at a time nationally and internationally. and they had like a field trip weekend, and so all the directors would like sign up to go on various field trips, and mine was to New Dramatists, which is how I learned about them and ended up working for them. But another one was with Youngblood, mm-hmm. which is Ensemble Studio Theater's writers group for writers under 30. And they had the best time as these directors and playwrights, and there was like all these like pictures of them on this summer retreat, like out in the Catskills or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the picture of all the directors and writers and saw Liz Merriweather, who was a year below me in undergrad. And I was like, oh, hey, she's part of this group. Well, if she can do it, then I can do it too. And I think that that was pretty much the last thing that I could do that she could do. and after that, she could do all these things that I'll never do. But yeah, that was like really the sort of pivot point that I was like, oh, she's like getting this, proto-professional opportunity at EST, and I'd like to chase after that too. And I got into Youngblood the same year that I got into my U Writers Lab, which is where I met my wife. And so between those two groups, like, I just really fell for writing and like kind of cold stopped directing.
Talk about Mayi.
Oh yeah, so they I've been in residence with them since 05, and their lab is the largest collective of Asian American playwrights ever assembled in the history of recorded time, is what we say at the curtain speeches. And it got started by this writer Sung No, and a couple years before I joined, and then by the time I joined, it was being run by Lloyd Sa and Kui Gwin, and I joined with two other writers. One of them was Rahana, and one of them is Dustin Chin, who's one of my best friends. Just like, it was really, the two writers groups were really formative. Like, Youngblood was really formative for developing my comedic voice and like for having this like healthy sense of camaraderie and competition among my writers, because they were all real up-and-comers that were, you know, doing well. And Mayi was like where my moral compass formed, because we were all wrestling with like, what's our responsibility as Asian American writers, and like sort of like as artists generally, and like how do we deal with the sort of what we would now call kind of structural inequality in theater? How do we support our community? Like, are we obligated to write Asian characters? Are we obligated to write Asian stories? Like, what is the sort of perception in the field about like what an Asian story should look like? Because I think that there's I think that people will look back at the work that's come out of the lab and like this sort of, you know, 10-15 year history of the lab and really realize that it was a like kind of shocking turning point nationally for Asian American writers, because a lot of the people that came out of the lab are now doing plays in sort of larger mainstream theaters and are really benefiting from like what we were pushing up against kind of collectively there. And so yeah, like we would just bring in pages of stuff that we were working on. And after a couple of years, Rahana and I got married and took over the lab, and then ran it for a few years, and then she stepped down because she was having to do a lot of the grunt work and I was getting a lot of the credit, and so it was completely fair.
Right. Yeah.
And then I've been running it with Ray Pamatmat for a couple of years. And now he's moving to Seattle, so we're figuring out what to do next.
So do you feel a responsibility for community or writing Asian plays in a certain way or Asian characters in a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, but it's a really evolving consciousness. Like, one of my biggest fights that I've ever had with Rahana was she came back from this Asian theater conference that, and she used to run a South Asian company called Disciplina that was like, which is a combination of Desi for, you know, her South Asian side and Pina for her Filipino side. Mm-hmm. And so she came back really excited from this like conference on Asian theater. And I was like, I don't think I would want to do that. And she was like, why wouldn't you want to do that? Like, are you a race traitor? I'm like, no, I'm not a race traitor. And like, I mean, we really kind of got at it because I like from the directing side of things, like I wanted to cast Asians, not necessarily in like Asian specific roles, and felt like that was limiting. But then if there are not enough Asian-specific stories, then you're not really getting to see actors sort of do the full range of what they're capable of doing. And there's not enough sort of generalized casting or sort of like color-conscious casting out there. You know, so there's a flip side of responsibilities, I think, that like you not only have to cast Asian artists like sort of in general roles, but you also have to write specific roles, but then...
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like, I really pushed hard against this perception of like big theaters want me to write like an immigrant coming to America play that I don't know how to write as a third generation Chinese American. Like, right. So my grandparents immigrated, and like, and when I, like my first couple of years of writing, like my most successful plays to date had been about Asian specific stories, and I didn't know sort of, is that because those are my best plays because they're like what, you know, where I'm bringing the most of myself to them, or is it because of sort of preconceptions around like what I should be, you know, I mean, it's like a real mindfuck. And like, so where I'm at now is just that like, I'm trying to write a sort of gamut of works, and some of them are Asian specific, like sort of the entire theme of it is Asian. Some of them are just sort of like Asian specific roles. Some of them are general, but I'm going to cast Asians in them. And like, but I do think that like, in the same way that the lab has formed a really sort of viable long-term community of writers that are pushing against each other and coming up with great work, like I think that I feel an obligation to explode that nationally, so that like we're putting out plays that like that designers can, you know, Asian designers can work on, that directors, Asian directors can work on. I think that like that's been one of the places where I've been most remiss, is that like it's so hard to find directors that are great interpreters of your work in the first place, like, and my production opportunities have been relatively limited thus far, and so like one of my biggest kind of pushes for this next phase of my career is just to try to like bring in more Asian directors, because I haven't been working with them as much as I should be.
Can you talk a little bit about Teenage Dick and how your approach to playwriting has sort of like culminated in this particular play that's going on right now?
Yeah, so Teenage Dick was commissioned from the Apathite, which is Greg Muscala's company, and Greg has cerebral palsy and founded this company to explore the disabled experience. And we had met through Youngblood, because he was a regular actor there and a former writer there. And a lot of our politics about, his politics about disabled representation and the same kinds of struggles of like, what's my obligation to create stories about disability as opposed to sort of being an actor out in the world who is disabled, paralleled really closely with like, what is my responsibility to write Asian American stories, or sort of, you know, to just be sort of an Asian American out in the world. And so from that dialogue and from kind of mutual admiration, he'd been in one of my Youngblood shorts that actually Moritz directed, called The Roosevelt Cousins, The Early Sauced, where Greg played a drunk FDR at a polio clinic. So Greg and I kind of paired up on this idea of doing an adaptation of Richard III set in high school called Teenage Dick. And this was in 2012. And at the time I was midway through Juilliard and was sort of like, I'm not going to be able to incorporate this idea into sort of all the other stuff that I have floating around, but I'm really dedicated to doing it. And wrote a first draft in like 2013, and then just like workshopped it all around the country. It was like, in some ways, like a real blessing and also a real slog, because there's, I think that there's like a almost like a, how do I put this? Like a gap for playwrights in trust between like when a play is actually production ready and when a theater deems it to be production ready. Mm-hmm. And that gap is very nebulous in terms of like risk or like, you know, like unknown writer and sort of, you know what I mean? That there's like a lot of like, oh, you have to workshop this play in order for us to know that it's ready to go. But like, you don't ever really know. Nobody, if anybody knew how to bottle success, is, you know, like they would have hit out of your head. So it's like, you're like, artistic directors are either like not aware of like sort of plays that are out there, or they're just sort of prioritizing people that they already know. And then you have this like weird thing that sticks out like a weed that you're like, I don't know what to do with this. Like, I don't know if I can cast this. I don't know if, you know, so we rode that wave for several years, and all the while we're kind of like hammering away at it. And like a year or so out, Moritz joined on, and then an actor named Shannon DeVito, who plays the character of Buck, was at it for the first reading, which was at Mai. So the four of us have stuck on this thing for like about 5-6 years. And it's having its world premiere now.
How did you come to relate Richard III to what you started to like? Like, what was the inspiration point between this old
Shakespeare play and what you very, very contemporary play that you ended up writing.
Yeah, I mean, Greg specifically came up with this idea of like of trying to recapture the most famous disabled character of all time and stick him in a high school. And he's like, and it was sort of like, I don't know what you're going to come up with, but you know, see what that does for you. And for me, the way that I kind of parallel it is that like a lot of the most famous representations of Asians in theater are written by non-Asians, and like and you have these sort of archetypes that then actors have to wrestle with in terms of how to like make it their own. Mm-hmm. And I'm able-bodied, but for Greg, I think to have this like archetypal character out there that was written by an able-bodied person without sort of thinking about like any deeper implications of disability beyond kind of really just sort of stereotypes about like this sort of evil, mm-hmm. evil person. He wanted to kind of get in there and sort of see what would happen if we exploded that or sort of looked at how we regard disability today versus then. Because there's the sort of flip side of that today is these condescending narratives about like overcoming or about like mm-hmm. you're a saint because of your circumstance, and you know, but it's yeah. like they're both ways of not really taking a person in. Mm-hmm. And so that was one impulse, and the other impulse was that we keep on doing these Shakespeare revivals, and there's this high florid language, and like, what do you do with that? And how do you make that kind of language still sing today? Mm-hmm. So there's a mashup in this play of like this high Shakespearean language and like more contemporary slang. And yeah, those were kind of the starting points and just sort of...
Has it been helpful for you or for the play that it has had this familiar title as sort of like to hang its hat on in a way?
I think that what's been really enormously helpful is that like audiences come in thinking that they know what it is because they're mm-hmm. like, okay, like it's going to be a fun lark in high school. And like, I recognize some of these lines and I mm-hmm. see what you're doing. And like, I like from the first sort of couple minutes, and Greg is very disarming. So from the first couple minutes, you're like, I'm rooting for this guy and I know what this play is and I'm going to be in for a relaxing ride. And then we go on a really like unexpected journey, I think, and one that's shocking. And so yeah, like having that title and having just sort of like, I already have the kind of structural forebear of Richard, like, and therefore I'm safe, but you're not, mm-hmm. has been helpful.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go next?
I mean, I don't know about you. You were saying that, like, you're piecing through plays, like, up to maybe even a year in advance. Like, mm-hmm. and I'm the same way where it's like, I'll be actively thinking about a play before I set any pen to paper for a good year or so. So what's weird is that, like, I already know kind of my next couple of projects, but I don't know what's after that, like, what's not in motion yet, and that's scary to me, to mm-hmm. not know what's after what's already kind of going.
Yeah.
But what's already going is I'm heading towards the end of a musical that I co-wrote with Rahana on Book, and then we have a composer named Sam Wilmot, and it's called Bangin' It, mm-hmm. and it's an intercollegiate Bhangra musical. So it's about two competing Bhangra teams and takes the sort of structure of like a Bring It On or something to mm-hmm. look at South Asian acculturation and biraciality. But it's a real fun danceical.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And then I have a commission with Adam Guan to write another musical that we're just starting now. And then I'm also working on a trilogy with Rahana about the after effects of British colonialism. So that's all that I know that I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then after that, I don't know. But that's like... I mean, have you ever felt like this where it's like it takes so much to like get a play up, right? And it's like so much mental energy to not only conceive of this idea, but like really see it through. And a lot of like what happens in a physical production is so circumstantial that like, you know, that it's like this yeah. particular set of collaborators and like the way that, you know, certain lines hit actors and kind of the limitations of your space, this is the physical manifestation of this thing. And then to think about like rolling a new boulder up a new hill is like so exhausting, which kind of is why I kind of going back to the question about staffing, like I do want to do that again, but I don't know what the next thing is. And it's just like the idea of like having to come up with this whole new world and like push that up the hill for another 5 years is so overwhelming.
But perhaps the idea of like maybe a year, maybe a season, right, staffed on a show would be a nice little break.
It would be like a, like yeah,
a palate
like,
cleanser for, yeah, for your playwriting.
I mean, for me personally, I think that I'm gonna try to see out the stuff that's already in motion, and then just sort of think about where I'm at, because I also feel like, do you have abandoned plays that you go back and you look at them, and sometimes you don't
constantly. It's constant because it's almost like recycling. Like I feel like I'm. It's bad for the environment that I created this thing that nothing has happened with.
So then, what do you do with those like drawer plays? Like, do you reconceive them? Do you keep working on them? Like,
well, usually I'll reconceive in some way because they clearly didn't work.
Mm.
So I will go back and I'll rethink. Usually, what I'll learn is when I've written these plays that have gone to a drawer, I got notes on them that I just didn't believe in, or they didn't connect with me,
yeah,
at the time,
totally.
But they were right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but at the time I wasn't ready to hear,
yeah,
them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So, but they're still with me. So I will go back to those notes, and usually they're not even written down. They're in my head, because when people are giving me notes that I'm like, I won't even write them down, but I will years later then rethink them and be like, oh my God, that director was totally right.
It's such an art, isn't it? Like, when to give a note, because it's like, if you're not in the right place for it, it just like completely jams you up, even if they're right. Like,
yeah.
I mean, on my end, like I have a lot of plays in drawers, and I'm okay with abandoning them at a certain point, because I go back and I'm like, I don't know who that writer was that like could, mm-hmm, think in that way. And like, I don't write in that style anymore, you know, but what I do feel like is that there's like some kind of, oh, how do we even put this? It's like some of those drawer plays, like you like come up with another way to tell that same story.
Yeah.
And it's like, essentially it's the same play, but like you're sophisticated now and you're like in a different,
yeah,
place, and you're,
yeah,
able to tackle it in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So all of which is to say that like the idea of like kind of completely starting new is scary, but like maybe I should go back and look at like the stuff that never saw the light of day and sort of be like, what was I dealing with over here? And I wonder, you know?
Yeah. I have a couple of plays that, like the first play I ever tried to write, the first full length play I ever tried to write, just never worked. And I came back to it every 3 years or so. And a year ago I finally found its form, like what it needs to be. And it went from a super meta theatrical play with lots of weird moving parts to a straightforward 75 minute narrative, single like unit set narrative play.
It's same characters and same like
characters. A couple were eliminated, a couple were added, but the heart of the same story, same exact story. And it took me like six passes through this thing over the course of 10 years before it found what I think is its truest form.
There's also something cruel about like some plays come easy and some plays come incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And there's no real correspondence to like how good they are. It's not like every play that's extremely difficult is your best play.
Oh,
like,
right. Yeah.
Sometimes plays that come really easy are your best play or whatever. But like,
yeah.
I totally hear you on like that, like, every 3 year kind of like get it out again and just like try to stab it again. And like,
and it's when I'm in an in-between place with other things where I'm like, okay, I'm ready to do something else. What's really, you know, haunting me right now? Oh, it's this thing. I feel wasted. You know, I feel like I spent all this time on it, and sometimes I'll just go and repurpose stuff. Like I'll just grab scenes, or I'll grab a character, and I'm like, oh, this character actually belongs in this play over here. Because I'm writing about a lot of the same stuff, and it's very personal. So I'm writing about things that are that I'm chewing on personally, and a lot of them are connected in a lot of ways. So it's kind of easy for me to steal a moment or a character from this one play and plug it into another one. And then I'll feel like I made that old play useful. And then I can throw that away.
Do you have like, are you looking through paper drafts, or are you looking through like old files, or like?
Old files, yeah.
I haven't done a lot of that. What's weird is that, like, I save obsessively, like, drafts, you know?
Yeah.
Actually, it helped me out with Teenage Dick because my director, Moritz, was like, you used to have this scene before in an old draft, and I'd forgotten that. And he was like, you used to have this line here. I mean, that's really helpful, right, having somebody that remembers this shit because, like, I have a two-year-old, and I just, like, I don't remember anything right now. And, like, so it's possible that you've come upon the best solution to something years ago and you just forgot, you know? So he remembered some of that, but in terms of like old plays, I haven't done that kind of diving.
Yeah. I am obsessed with it. Sometimes I'll write something that I feel is so perfectly encapsulating or perfectly articulating something I deeply care about that just doesn't fit in a play or in the play I wrote it for, and it has to be cut. It's one of the children we need to kill. And that hurts me so much that I don't feel settled until I find a home for that piece. And there's this one monologue that I wrote. It's a very long story, and it just bogged down this one particular play when I first wrote it. And it floated around in my head and landed in another play. And I like it was like it that was like me forcing it. No, it didn't fit.
It still didn't.
Because I was like, it's gonna go here. And then I was like, it doesn't fit here, and I'm ruining this play. So I pulled it out, and then years later, it found its home in this other play.
And it fits there.
It fits there like I wrote it for that. Like,
wow.
It belonged there.
And again,
a lot of that is because I'm ruminating and chewing on a lot of the same things in different ways, in different plays.
I have such trouble with those moments because I tend to get rid of them like in a preview or something, but like there's a couple of those moments where it's sort of like, oh, this doesn't really belong in this play, but it's so specific to this play that you're like, where would I ever use that again? So I kind of just like love it so much that I'm gonna keep it, and then that stuff will invariably go. But I don't have anything like that that's like a monologue that's like so on point that it's like I'm gonna expurgate this in full and like find a way to jam it in, like,
yeah.
You know what I mean, like, usually they're like jokes or something that I'm just like, that's such a good joke, when would I ever use that again,
right? Yeah But I guess comics do that a lot, right? Like they spend a lot of this time like they'll throw out they'll workshop a joke and they're like, that doesn't work, it just doesn't work, and they'll keep trying it, and sometimes they'll cut it and then come back to it because they just realize, I found the entry point for it.
It's harder.
Or I found the hook for it, or whatever.
I mean, I feel so bad for Shannon DeVito, who plays Buck, because she's had like a good like two plays worth of material like cut.
Oh yeah.
She's just like, her delivery is so killer, and it's like she's like got all these great like joke lines that we just like, especially because the play was written in 2013 and now it's 2018, and like so the world has changed, and it's like a lot of the like topical stuff like that's just never gonna go.
Yeah, I have struggled a lot with writing things that relate to our current political climate for two reasons. One, it's changing so freaking fast. It's unbelievable how fast it's changing. And two, I've always found it important for my writing to find empathy for everybody. And I'm really struggling with finding empathy for a lot of people right now.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. Yeah. I especially because like for comedy, since so much is topical, I'm having a really hard time figuring out how to. I have so much to say about this current moment, and yet like it is going really fast, and I don't have my way in yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Do you have a favorite line or a favorite joke from Teenage Dick that you had to cut that you can share?
I can't remember. I'm sorry. I wish I had some gem for you about that, but I just like
that was my button to end this.
I was so sorry.
I was so ready for you to like just deliver this big laugh.
No, I can't. I also can't act, so you better not have.
All right. Well, it was a good try. I think we'll end there.
Yeah. Thanks so much. This was so fun.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you to Mike for the chat.
If you're in New York City, Teenage Dick runs at the Public Theater through July 29th. Get there and check it out. Thanks to American Theater and TCG for allowing us into your hallowed offices to record this month. Thanks, as always, to International Pen Pal for allowing us to use their song for the theme. And thanks to you for listening and sharing this podcast, because that's what you're doing, right? You're sharing it with all your loved ones and friends. If you like what you hear, please go rate and comment on iTunes. Rating is super easy. You just have to click. Commenting is for the super special people out there with the actual motivation to make words. Are you a super special person? Stay in touch with the Subtext on the Twitters at Subtext Podcast. Send an email if you have something you want to say privately, thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. Here we are once again at the end. Tune in next month to see me do a backflip off a high dive into a pool of Jell-O.